From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, CBS News anchors Nora O'Donnell and Gail King open CBS This Morning with a report on their co-host Charlie Rose, who's been suspended now that at least 8 women who worked or tried to work with him on his PBS show have come forward to accuse him of making crude sexual advances. Here's O'Donnell.
It takes a lot of courage for these women to come forward, and I think that they should continue to do something.
We hope that they will continue to speak up.
Yeah. I also want to say this, that this is a moment that demands a frank and honest assessment about where we stand and more generally the safety of women. Let me be very clear. There is no excuse for this alleged behavior.
Both O'Donnell and King also said this came as a shock to them, maybe because Rose owned the company that produced his PBS show and had power over hirings at CBS with them. He did not. Of course, Rose is in a long line of men accused of sexual harassment, including at NPR. And just this morning, longtime Michigan Congressman John Conyers denied settling a claim 2 years ago with a woman who claimed she was fired from his Washington staff because she rejected his sexual advances. Let's check in on this moment with Rebecca Onion, staff writer for Slate. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you write a terrific piece. We're going to link people to it about the recent history here. Women have only been in the workforce in these numbers in recent decades. Long before that, it was largely poor women, women of color, who suffered harassment in silence. In the 70s, feminist leaders realized this isn't about sex. It's about power, keeping women in their place. Talk more about that.
Yeah, so I went back and looked at a bunch of the writing that 70s feminists had done on sexual harassment when they really were trying to connect it to other issues about, you know, talking about the pay gap, talking about rape and other forms of violence against women. And so they're really trying to make the argument that this is about men rejecting women gaining sort of economic independence. And so the harassment is a very effective way to quash people's impulses towards being more independent in their lives.
Well, there were landmark books written, as you said. There was a Supreme Court case only in 1986 brought by a black woman, Michelle Vinson. The Supreme Court established that the Civil Rights Act should protect women from these hostile work environments. But bring us to where we are now. Writer Masha Gessen worries that we're on the brink of a sex panic, an epidemic of puritanism that will take down innocent men. Your thoughts on this moment?
Well, I think I really respect Masha Gessen, and I love a lot of stuff that she writes. So I found it hard to read that because I felt like it was really indicative to me of the fact that our conversation has really been about how, you know, there's just gross men everywhere. You know, this sort of ongoing shock and just like complete sort of dislocation that people seem to be feeling, that this has been going on kind of quote unquote under our noses. Although of course you could argue that some of this stuff is open secrets that people have known and talked about for a while, like with the Louis C.K. allegations. But it's really not about whether or not individual men are quote unquote perverts or, you know, have like some kind of like sexual aberration in their psychology. I just think that's not a productive way to drive the conversation. I think we should be talking more about what the widespread incidence of this means about our relationship between the men and women.
Well, you say it should be about the structure that spawns these men. You know, this structure that still is about the same thing it was about in the 70s, it sounds like you're saying, the idea of keeping a patriarchy. And, you know, people have a hard time with that. They think, well, wait a minute. It wasn't Al Franken just a juvenile trying to, you know, get a little bit of, you know, something on the side. And wasn't, you mentioned Louis C.K. That sounds like someone who has an exhibitionist problem. So how does it all fall under that sense of holding on to power?
Well, it's a way, I found it really helpful to think about the ideology of separate spheres, which is kind of a really old school, 70s, 80s women history idea, that in the 19th century, there was this concept that women should be the ones at home and men should be the ones in public. And so this ideology kind of governed everything in 19th century life. And their argument, the 70s feminists, is that this idea that women should not be in public and should not be participating in the workplace is still kind of like latent within us. And so when you have, whether you have someone like Louis C.K. who's, you know, abusing the presence of these women, or you have someone who, like Harvey Weinstein, who, you know, is taking people who have ambitions to get ahead in the field that he has a lot of power in and then basically just diminishing them. The effect is the same. It's the idea that, you know, it says to the woman, you know, you shouldn't be here. You should go home. This is not an environment for you. And it becomes really hard for women to figure out what to do in those situations. So they're victimized sort of over and over again.
Well, and bringing us full circle here, you point out that what was happening in the 70s, that women were choosing to not go into the workforce on the path that they might have chosen. They were leaving because they felt no protection from this. The same thing's happening now. We hear from the comics who decided not to continue. We hear from the actresses who decided not to continue. Women are leaving the workforce because of this.
Yes, and there was a sociologist who I quote in my article who talks about, she did studies with this, talking about the diminishment in pay that people often experience when they do decide to leave a field where there's a lot of sexual harassment. And part of the reason why that happens is that often women will decide to go into a field that has a lot of women in it, you know, like teaching or nursing or, social work, something like that, because at least there you don't have to deal with this.
Yeah,
are underpaid fields.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's another reminder that while we're seeing these very high-level women who are coming forward, there's probably much more going on for women at the lower paid jobs. Rebecca Onion, staff writer for Slate, we'll link to all your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And the Trump administration is announcing new sanctions today against North Korea. It's part of the ongoing effort to deprive the country of the money it needs for its nuclear missile program. And it comes after yesterday's decision to redesignate North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism. So North Korea will now join Iran, Sudan, and Syria on that list. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst, and he is MIT's security study. He's with MIT's security studies program. Jim, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Putting North Korea back on this list comes along with some new sanctions that will impose what the administration is calling maximum pressure. Does it carry any heft, or is it just symbolism?
I think there might have been a time when the North Koreans cared about this. They cared enough about it that they wanted it removed. So that tells you a little bit, but a lot of water has flown under, come under the bridge since then. We've had sanctions and sanctions and sanctions and sanctions.
Right.
I'm not really sure one more sanction on something that is really quite an old law is going to matter very much.
What sanctions are left?
Well, the Congress could pass new sanctions over human rights or over some other issue, but basically there's no interaction between North Korea and the United States. And if anything, one has to be – I've written with my colleague John Park at Harvard on this. One has to be careful about unintended consequences. If you squeeze and squeeze and squeeze without thinking about what you're doing, the people who are really going to pay that price, it's not going to be the generals. Hmm. It's not going to be the Kim family.
The North Korean people.
It's going to be the vulnerable women and children who are, face food insecurity.
Well, let's put this into some historical context. North Korea had been deemed a sponsor of terrorism back in 1988. You mentioned this. You referred to that.
Yep.
That was after a South Korean passenger jet was bombed by North Korean agents. 115 people on the plane died. But the designation was then removed in 2008. It was part of an effort to get an agreement under the Bush administration to bring them to the negotiating table on the nuclear deal. That didn't work. Was it the right strategy at the time?
Well, did it work? Well, we started down a path that was going to restrain North Korea's weapons programs, and then that agreement fell apart for various reasons. So the thing is, I would say about this is that we're in a period of lull right now. We haven't had a lot of missile tests and nuclear tests. This is the chance for the U.S. and North Korea really to advance the engagement piece. Now, their policy is called maximum pressure and engagement, and we'll see whether this sort of roils the waters, because we normally in a given year we don't have that many opportunities because we're always either sanctioning or they're testing or there are military exercises.
Right.
So they're few and far between.
Well, the South Korean defense minister said today that the South Korean military is maintaining a firm readiness posture. So South Korea is wondering what's going to happen now.
Absolutely. And all along, you saw President Moon's comments before that there can be no war launched without consideration of South Koreans' wishes. They're the ones – South Korea is the place where a war will be fought. Naturally, they're a little touchy about it. So and I think most analysts are expecting a new wave of missile tests come – end of December, beginning of next year, and that creates all sorts of opportunities for mischief, intended and unintended. So, of course, the South Koreans are going to remain on guard.
But that would end the quiet period that you're mentioning.
If
these tests come back, that would end the quiet period. And a lot of analysts are saying, look, the Trump administration, and by putting this new designation in place is basically negating the chance of bringing them to the negotiating table and prompting them probably to finish off this this quiet period, right, and to bring them back.
Yeah, I don't know. And we don't know what the ultimate conclusion would be, you know, what the counterfactual history says. But it is true. I mean, probably in general, it doesn't matter, you know, one way or another, for good or for ill. But there is a chance that if we run into a problem down the road, we will look back in history and say, geez, we had a chance to sort of freeze this, try to bring some stability to it, and we didn't. Yeah. And that the timing of this was bad. The only other thing I would say, and I'm to be prickly about it, is I just don't think it's true. I mean, they don't support al-Shabaab. They don't support al-Qaeda. So we're sort of forcing one law and reinterpreting it to impose it when it really doesn't apply. And I worry about laws that are just sort of applied without rationale.
Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
We just heard that President Trump redesignated North Korea as a sponsor of terrorism. What about this war of words between Trump and Kim Jong-un? Could that become a real war? It's become an urgent question as both men have their fingers on the buttons of nuclear weapons. Or do they? The perception in the U.S. is that there is a man with a suitcase, the so-called nuclear football, assigned to trail an American president wherever he goes, and on the president's order, use that football to launch a nuclear strike. But Air Force General John Hyten, commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, was asked at last week's Halifax International Strategic Forum, what would he do if asked by President Trump to launch a nuclear strike?
I provide advice to the president. He'll tell me what to do, and if it's illegal, guess what's going to happen?
You say no.
I'm going to say, Mr. President, that's illegal. And guess what he's going to do? He's going to say, what would be legal? And we'll come up with options of a mix of capabilities to respond to whatever the situation is. And that's the way it works.
I've got a lot of people asking, what is legal? Bruce Blair is a former nuclear missile launch officer. He's co-founder of Global Zero. That's a group that advocates for eliminating nuclear weapons. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to join you.
Well, first of all, tell us, what is a nuclear missile launch officer?
It's a young person like myself who sits down at the bottom of an underground launch center waiting for orders to fire up to 50 missiles armed with nuclear weapons at targets in Russia, China, North Korea, Iran.
Oh.
And,
wow.
And this officer sits there and waits for the order. And once it comes, he checks or she checks the order against codes in their safe, and then process a checklist that takes about 1 minute to fire up to 50 missiles.
Well, that's a pretty intense job, but also I'm thinking one in which you don't do a lot.
Well, you can be busy doing other things like
right.
exercises and maintenance of missiles and all sorts of odd jobs.
Yeah, but thankfully not a lot of launching. But I'm sure you've thought a lot about what happens, you know, if you have to. So help us with this, because we know we had recent hearings that were called by congressmen, frankly, concerned about this current president of the United States. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut said he is so unstable, so volatile, has a decision-making process so quixotic, he might order a nuclear weapon strike that is wildly out of step with U.S. national security interests. So there were hearings. And in those hearings, we heard from Brian McKeon, a senior military policy advisor in the Pentagon. This was during the Obama administration. He said pretty much you couldn't thwart a president's will to launch a nuclear strike. But we just heard Hyten say, in effect, we thought he said you could. So what is to start with what the president's authority is?
Well, General Hyten would try to talk the president out of making a really bad decision, and certainly an illegal one, whatever that means. It's in the eye of the beholder, frankly. But the president has absolute authority, unilateral power to order the use of nuclear weapons.
We'll have to stop you there because that's what we wanted to know. What is illegal? What is legal? What did he mean?
It's hard to understand what is illegal because we have war plans that would launch thousands of nuclear warheads at targets all over the world, including right now 100 aim points in the greater Moscow area. So whatever has been pre-programmed apparently is considered to be a legal option for the president.
So if a president were, for instance, to say, I would like to strike France, presumably there are no missiles now pointing at France, and that would not be legal? I'm being hypothetical, but is that what you're saying?
Well, a strike on France or Canada or someplace would be outlandish. But I think the real concern here is that a president might initiate a nuclear strike without apparent cause in the context of a growing, escalating crisis with North Korea. The generals just have not been very reassuring in suggesting that they would resist an order that's illegal. They have not said that they would resist an order that doesn't really make a lot of sense, that's misguided, that's really a bad call. And they really can't without suggesting that they would be making the decisions on what needs to be done to protect America, not the president.
Not the president. Well, take us through what's supposed to happen. So let's say the president is feeling the need for something. What does he do first?
Well, the president would contact this military aide that carries the satchel with the war plans in it, that's a person that's always by the president's side, and ask to initiate an emergency conference with his advisors. That would include the Secretary of Defense, State Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and most importantly, the Commander of Strategic Forces out in Omaha, like General Hyten, who is the primary talker in a conference about nuclear options. And as General Hyten said, he would tell the president what his options are and their consequences, and then the president would choose one of these prepared options. For example, right now, there's an option for attacking North Korea with nuclear weapons, and the president could simply say, let's go for that.
And then he would order, what, the Pentagon to implement it?
That's correct. Listening in on this conversation is the war room in the Pentagon, and once they hear that the president has made a decision, they will challenge the president to authenticate using a special code known as the biscuit in the president's possession. Once that authentication passes, then the war room in the Pentagon would format and immediately transmit an order to launch nuclear forces. It's the length of a tweet. It would take them 1 or 2 minutes to format and transmit that directly down the chain of command to the executing commanders of the underground launch centers, the submarines, and the bombers. General Hyten and Strategic Command would receive the order at the same time. If they felt that it was a really bad call or illegal and they wanted to try to override it, they could try to transmit a termination order, but it would be too late.
Wow. Well, you know, if all these codes are authenticated, these weapons are fired within a minute or two and within 15 minutes for the submarine. So once it's authenticated, everything goes through quickly. But what if, to go back to the first step, what if that commander, let's say it was Hyten, tells the president, I don't want to give you options, or I don't think you have any options here. I'm refusing to do this. What happens then?
Well, he would just be bypassed, and the president would give the order and authenticate to the war room in the Pentagon, which would immediately implement the president's command. And General Hyten would be no longer really in the picture.
So short of trying to explain to a president whether somebody thinks this is a legal or illegal strike, and as you said, that's kind of hazy anyway. It sounds like short of that, there's really, you know, as you have said at the outset, this really is up to the president.
That's right. In my view, the first use of nuclear weapons is almost invariably going to be illegal because they will cause collateral damage against civilian populations and in other ways violate the law of war. But that's not really the way that it's viewed from the inside.
Well, and just to underscore what you've just said, you're the guy who has run simulators. And as you've said, you know, you've practiced fighting nuclear wars, you know, hundreds of times. And from your view, using them in anything but a defensive way, you know, as a response to a launch from another country is illegal. But that it's almost it sounds like you're saying is immoral because, again, there's no legal aspect here.
At any rate, the legal question falls by the wayside if the president has carte blanche to order the use of nuclear weapons and all the means at his disposal to ensure that his decision is quickly implemented.
Look, is there concern in your community, as I expressed, that there is concern on the part of some, you know, in Washington, that this is a particular president who's thin-skinned, who's volatile, who is there particular concern about the way the U.S. has constructed its use of nuclear weapons?
Well, this issue transcends President Trump, but clearly his temperament and character have raised the issue to the surface, and we're now embroiled in a debate about whether there should be more checks and balances on the President of the United States.
And what do you think?
I think there definitely needs to be. And I think a good proposal would be to add more people to the chain of command for the first use of nuclear weapons. And a number of ideas along those lines are percolating and being advanced by the U.S. Congress.
That's Bruce Blair, former missile launch officer. He was the one whose finger would be on that button, a co-founder of Global Zero Now, a group that advocates eliminating nuclear weapons. When did that happen for you, by the way, Bruce, that sense of, wait a second, this is what I'm sure you found it both a privilege and a burden to be in that position, but when did it happen that you said, I don't even, you know, I want to get rid of these?
Well, Robin, I worked my entire career on the risks of the use of nuclear weapons, mostly at the Brookings Institution, and at some point I decided that given the proliferation of weapons to more countries and all of the risks of accidental and unauthorized use, a bad call by an irrational person, that all of those risks just can't be managed indefinitely. We have to eliminate all nuclear weapons, or inevitably they're going to be used probably in our lifetimes. There's really no long-term management of these risks.
And of course, the argument against that would be you never know when a North Korean erratic leader is working on nuclear weapons of his own. So you have to defend against that, and round and round we go.
Bruce, no, you do know. You do know. There's never been a country that has produced enough material for a nuclear weapon without having that project exposed to foreign intelligence, going all the way back to our Manhattan Project during World War II.
Well, so don't you have to have weapons to oppose their weapons?
Yeah. Global Zero supports the multilateral elimination of all nuclear weapons. We're not proposing the unilateral elimination of American weapons while other countries have them.
Right, right. Got you. Bruce Blair, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
There's a new poll out today from NPR, PBS NewsHour, and Marist that says most Americans who celebrate Thanksgiving are dreading political talk around the dinner table. The poll also asked people about President Trump's job performance, civility in American politics, the pending tax overhaul in Congress, and workplace sexual harassment. NPR reporter Jessica Taylor is with us now. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Peter.
58% of Americans are dreading talking politics at Thanksgiving. What else did the numbers tell us about that?
It's pretty across the board for people of all political stripes that are really sort of dreading this talk of politics, which isn't surprising with the polarized environment that we have now. But it is a little bit more for Democrats. Two-thirds of Democrats said that they don't want to talk politics with their relatives and friends and family. Only about half of Republicans said that. And overall, only 31% said that they were eager to broach this topic of conversation as they're talking over turkey and stuffing.
And it was actually worse than last year, right?
That's right. We had a CNN poll that we could compare it to. About 53% last year said that this was something they were dreading. So it does show us that this level of discourse and civility has certainly permeated even families over the past year.
Okay, so it may be a challenging Thanksgiving holiday. But the poll also asked people to rate the president's job performance. How did President Trump do?
He only has a job approval in this poll of 39%, and I was talking to our pollsters there at Marist, and over the past 11 times that they've asked this over the past year, he's been pretty steady in between 35 and 39%. And the bottom line is these are not good numbers, especially for a president in his first year. Typically, you see a president sort of getting a honeymoon period. Mm-hmm. President Trump has not had that. These people that are approving of him are essentially his base, which has remained strong with him, but he has not been able to expand that over the past year.
Also, news has been coming in over the past day about sexual harassment accusations, new ones against TV host Charlie Rose, New York Times journalist Glenn Thrush, Michigan Congressman John Conyers. This is something that the poll asked about, the topic in general, very timely. What are Americans thinking about that?
Well, we asked people if they had been victims of sexual harassment in their workplace. One in three women said that they had been. One in five overall, including men, said that they had been. And older women were more likely to say that they had been victims of this. But overall, people did think that their workplaces were actually taking this seriously. 88% said that they believed that if they made complaints to their HR department or otherwise, that they believed that they would be taken seriously.
Hmm. Finally, and we talked a little bit about this before, the poll results show that 67% of adults believe the tone and level of civility in Washington has declined since Donald Trump was elected president. Americans, though, are more optimistic about the discourse in their communities. So if you, it's kind of interesting. If you look at it maybe from a more local level, people are feeling okay about things. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're talking with your neighbors or something, or people that you maybe associate with, they're more likely to sort of have the same political views that you are, too. And so if you're talking maybe about local issues, a bridge or some sort of local funding issue, there seems to be, you know, more ability to sort of find things and come together. But I think people that, you know, aren't in the D.C. bubble that we are here, where I am in Washington, they're very frustrated, I think, with their representatives. And when they broach those national issues, that's where I think we see a lot of difference. And especially as we see people, again, bringing it back to Thanksgiving, that is where I think you do get a lot of different generations, a lot of different people coming together. And that's where I think sometimes the talk can turn a little testy.
All right. NPR's Jessica Taylor talking to us about this new NPR poll. 58% of Americans who are celebrating Thanksgiving dread talking about politics. Jess, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Home prices in major American cities are moving on up. A report out last week by the real estate firm Redfin showed that 9 markets saw double-digit growth over the past year. Prices in San Jose, California jumped 19%, in Seattle almost 17%, and in Las Vegas the median sales price grew by about 15%. But one of the biggest metro areas in the country lagged behind, as it has for several years now. In fact, a September report by UBS said Chicago is one of 20 global cities where housing is undervalued and prices remain below their 2006 peak. So let's take a closer look.
So.
Very nice.
Isn't this nice?
Yeah. Evi Bogato is a realtor in the Chicago suburb of Homewood. She's been showing me around the city.
There's like a little parlor. This feels like a really old house here, you know, just to welcome your guests at the house.
This house is the best property we've seen by far. The parlor leads to a spacious kitchen, wood floors throughout, and the living room.
Looks beautiful.
Big fireplace. Isn't it pretty?
Vaulted ceilings.
Vaulted ceilings, wood on the ceiling so you don't have to paint. A nice little deck.
Yeah. What's this one cost?
$249. Yeah. It's high for here.
We walk upstairs, and by the time we get to the master, I'm still thinking about the price.
$249,000. You said this is high for this area. I'm just thinking, you know, this house is beautiful.
This house, the original part of this house was built in 1931, and it's tastefully done.
Yeah. And if this house were in some other equally large city in the country, I'm thinking on one of the coasts,
okay.
It'd have been way over $500,000, probably closer to $1 million, and it probably would have sold almost as soon as it went on the market.
A 2,000 square foot house, the West Coast, I can't even imagine what a 2,000 square foot house is going to cost, especially one that's done as nicely as this one.
Yeah. Are you in some big cities, we're seeing bidding wars, people coming in with cash. Are you seeing that here?
There are bidding wars because inventory is very low. Right now in Homewood, there's 2.7 month supply of inventory. That means if the houses that are listed today, if buyers keep buying them at the rate that they are, in 2.7 months, all the houses will be gone and there will be nothing for sale.
So because of that, prices are inching up here.
Prices are appreciating, right. Yeah. And we call this a seller's market.
It's a seller's market because supply is tight and demand for new homes is high. It's a problem across the country. Redfin says the number of homes for sale nationwide plunged last year at a rate not seen since 2013. And home builders haven't responded with enough new construction. That's what's driving up prices in many cities. But here in the Chicago suburbs,
they're coming up between 3 and 3.5, sometimes a little bit more, percent a year.
To you then, this feels good. This feels right.
Yes, this feels very solid. If you live on the East Coast and the West Coast and you want a lot of house for your money, come to Chicago. Because you'll be amazed. You'll have money for trips and doing all kinds of things if you come here.
And Bogato points out another difference.
I think much of Chicagoland is a very blue-collar area. Okay, there's lots of factory workers. There were steel mills here over the years. They're just regular people. You know, we don't have really expensive industries here.
And many of the blue-collar jobs that helped build this area are gone. The U.S. Census Bureau says nearly 20,000 people left Greater Chicago in 2016 for places like Arizona and Texas. It was the biggest drop for any metro area in the country, and it's been happening for years.
It's challenged.
Jeff Smith is director of DePaul University's Institute for Housing Studies. We're at Homewood's Amtrak station, where commuters make the 45-minute train ride into the city.
In the south suburbs, you've seen some long-term headwinds to a strong housing market. You've seen some economic changes as a lot of the industrial jobs that supported and attracted a lot of folks to the neighborhood have gone away. At the same time, you've seen some demographic changes in terms of reduced incomes. You've also seen rising property tax burdens in the south suburbs. So all those are sort of long-term challenges.
In the short term, Smith says home prices around here were hit hard by the housing crisis and still haven't returned to pre-recession levels.
Yeah, that means there are a lot of underwater homeowners, which holds back the market in many ways. You've had a lot of foreclosure activity, and so those are all factors.
That's surprising because across the country, it feels like we've stopped talking about foreclosures and short sales and people being underwater on their mortgages. It seemed as if we've gotten through that.
Regionally, there has been the recovery has been a bit stronger in other parts of the Chicago region and parts of the city of Chicago, but the south suburbs in particular have been particularly challenged.
And how much is that dragging down the entire region then? Is that why we're seeing headlines like this time last year, 2017 will be the Chicago will see the weakest housing market in the country? Why we're seeing reports from UBS that says of all global cities in the country, Chicago is perhaps the most undervalued?
Yeah, I think the south suburbs are kind of at the extreme end of the market, but I do think some of the challenges, you have slower population growth in Chicago. Economic growth has also been slower, and those are two big components that affect demand for housing.
People are moving away.
Right. Well, people are moving away, and also, you don't see growth in households as well, right? So those are both pretty significant factors.
Now, I want to be fair to Chicago as a region because I've been driving around talking to people for the last day or so, and I've been in downtown Chicago where I see new high-rise condominium buildings. I talk to people about affordability problems, and they feel that there are gentrification issues going on in downtown Chicago. What's the market like in other places?
Yeah, well, I think that there's a lot of variation within the region, in terms of both metrics that you look at to track positive market indicators. You're seeing house price appreciation in a number of neighborhoods in the city that have hit all-time highs. You're seeing lots of new development taking place downtown, lots of new development taking place along transit lines. You're seeing a lot of investment happening in certain parts of the city. So I wouldn't paint the picture completely bleak.
In fact, some people say not bleak at all. In downtown Chicago, the streets are crammed with cars and pedestrians. On Michigan Avenue, the towers rise toward the sky. And 8 floors up, inside the headquarters of the Chicago Association of Realtors, Rebecca Thompson likes what she sees.
Absolutely. It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah, so the Chicago River is right there. What else can we see?
Well, we have, of course, the new Apple Store, which has been booming ever since they rolled out their new phone. We have the Plaza with Google now setting up a little pop-up shop. But the whole city skyline, it's great to look out here and just see all of the interesting development, some of which has been fairly recent.
So from this vantage point here, what does the picture of Chicago area real estate look like to you?
I would definitely say Chicago is booming.
She points to big investments by Google and McDonald's. Next year, the burger chain is moving from Oak Brook, Illinois, to a brand new $250 million Chicago headquarters.
And who knows, maybe Amazon in the near future. So there's been a lot of interest in what we have going on down here.
You'll have some competition with Amazon, that's for sure. But you got the Chicago River running right through this area. We can see it from the window. What kind of real estate are you seeing developing down there on the waterfront?
Well, on the waterfront, a lot of the land has already been built up, but a lot of the new construction that we're starting to see, definitely high-rise, high-end luxury development. For quite some time, we saw a lot of luxury rental development, so it's been good to see a shift with a little bit more condominium available for purchase.
What are the prices like down here?
I would say you can purchase something around $200,000 if you're looking at a studio in a potentially new but maybe a more historic building, and you can go all the way up to the seven figures for sure.
But that $200,000 condo on the river in the country's third largest city is still a pretty good deal, and that's why Thompson loves hearing stories about Chicago's undervalued housing market.
You compare it to a potential bubble situation in San Francisco, New York, or a much lower risk investment for someone looking to purchase.
She sees it as an opportunity, especially when homeownership is increasingly out of reach in many American cities. And looking at other places around the country, Redfin's report says home prices in Salt Lake City, Utah, up 13% over the last year. Columbia, South Carolina, down about 5.5%. We'll link you to more of the numbers at hereandnow.org.
Today, the FCC announced a December vote on repealing Obama-era net neutrality regulation. Now, these are the requirements that internet service providers enable access to all content, that they not favor or block products or websites. The FCC is now under Trump appointee Ajit Pai, who's in favor of sacking those rules to give provider companies like AT&T and Comcast more control. Now, quick disclosure, NPR's legal counsel has filed comments with the FCC on the new proposal. NPR is in opposition to getting rid of the Obama-era rule. Let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech to find out more. Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of Policy and Politics for Recode. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first, did I get my definition right? Net neutrality?
Yeah, net neutrality is the idea that internet providers like AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, and Charter have to treat all web traffic equally. So they can't block websites, they can't slow them down, and they can't do what folks call fast lanes. So they can't charge content companies for faster delivery of their movies, music, and other sorts of streaming content. And under the Obama administration, there were tough rules in place that treated internet providers like utilities in order to ensure that they didn't tamper with net neutrality. But as you said, Chairman Ajit Pai, who's a Republican at the FCC now, has started the clock on repealing those rules. And at the end of the day, the FCC won't have very many net neutrality rules in place.
Well, because some of these providers don't like these rules, because suddenly we have this explosion in the last few years of streaming video, Netflix, using a lot of bandwidth. And what is, in fact, the company's objection to those services?
Yeah, streaming video definitely has exploded in recent years, not the least because it's something consumers want on their smartphones. And as consumers begin to watch more of those videos while they're on the go, they put a bit of a strain on the networks operated by AT&T and Verizon and others. And so those companies have to do something to relieve congestion. And from time to time, that's been exploring ways to, you know, reduce the quality of the video, perhaps slow down its delivery so that other folks can access that content. And there are a lot of folks in the net neutrality side who just say that they shouldn't be doing that, that they should leave the bits alone. And then there's a side issue. It's a business case for AT&T and Verizon and others. If consumers are going to gravitate towards streaming video, they want to offer that video in the most exclusive way possible. So they've sought out ways to broker deals with content owners. And that, too, is problematic to net neutrality advocates who just believe that consumers should be able to access what they want, when they want, how they want it.
Well, don't the company, let's argue on the side of the companies like AT&T, the providers. These streaming videos, Netflix, for instance, they take up so much broadband. They, you know, the companies say we should be able to charge more for them because we're in effect subsidizing these content providers like Netflix.
Yeah, the flip side of that being that companies like Google and YouTube and Netflix or others are the reasons that consumers buy the broadband subscriptions in the first place. Mm-hmm. They want that content, and they get it from their broadband provider. So it's a bit of a chicken and an egg problem. And if you're also an AT&T or a Verizon or so forth, one of your big arguments against the Obama administration had to do with investment. They claim that the Obama administration's FCC put rules in place that were so onerous that they spent more time complying with them and money to comply with them, and the uncertainty led led them to invest less in their networks. So that's one of the things that FCC Chairman Ajit Pai is now arguing, that lessening the regulation might spur new investment, but that ultimately remains to be seen.
Well, meanwhile, he's called for this vote in December of the FCC commissioners to overturn again the Obama-era net neutrality rules. And when I say Obama-era, they've only been in place since 2015. And that vote in December to overturn them is expected to pass 3-2 on party lines. What are tech companies saying about this?
Well, Republicans, as you perfectly pointed out, do have the votes to do this. It seems at the moment to be a foregone conclusion. And so that's put tech companies and consumer advocates who like net neutrality in a bit of a bind. They're not going to be able to sway Republicans who have promised that they were going to repeal net neutrality for many years now. So some have focused their efforts on Capitol Hill, hoping that lawmakers can broker some sort of long-term compromise, while others are exploring their legal options. Remember, we're at this moment because there's been lawsuit after lawsuit challenging the government's approach under both Democratic and Republican administrations. So we're pretty likely to see another court challenge after Chairman Pai adopts his order, which could mean this issue is something we're talking about perhaps years from now.
Well, but if not, let's say, you know, this administration does follow through on what it wants to do. Should people be prepared to pay more for their Netflix? I mean, what could happen if, in fact, the net neutrality rules are overturned?
This is a difficult question to answer because the rules have been in place for so long. Companies haven't been willing to test the waters, or in some case, they weren't able to. And a lot of the harms that net neutrality supporters point out, the very things they're trying to prevent, are hypotheticals. A world in which, you know, websites were blocked and you maybe weren't able to access the streaming movies and music that you wanted. But we don't have any examples of that because it just hasn't happened. That being said, there's always this fear about higher prices. There's always this fear that the telecom companies are going to run amok. But if you talk to them, if you talk to AT&T and Verizon and others, they insist that they are committed to net neutrality, that they don't want to tamper with the web, and that even if they did do something like that, they know that their customers would flock elsewhere, creating a market incentive against them tampering with the web too much.
Something else would be created. Tony Rahm, Senior Editor of Policy and Politics for Recode, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We'll check out that vote in December. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.